Happy New Year, and welcome back to Green Connections Radio, where we help you live green, work green, and earn green. I'm John Michelson. Find us on Talkers Radio Network and on greenconnectionsradio.com. Like us on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at Joan Michelson. We're going to start off 2014 with a look at energy-efficient neighborhoods, innovations that are making our communities more livable and more resourceful. To start off with, we're going to hear from Melanie Nutter, head of San Francisco's Department of the Environment. They're doing a very innovative zero waste program. Can you imagine a city having zero waste? Doesn't really sound possible, does it? Well, she'll tell us how they're doing it and about their cool app. You'll really love their app. And speaking of waste, does your city recycle? Believe it or not, only 8% of the plastic generated in the U.S. is actually recycled. So we're going to hear from Melissa Walsh Innes, a leader in the movement to literally reinvent recycling. Then we are thrilled to bring you my conversation with the legendary Amory Lovins, who has been leading the clean energy revolution for decades, including with his best-selling book, Reinventing Fire. And since our neighborhoods start at home, we'll hear from World Wildlife Fund executive and author Kia Chatterjee, who will tell us how she and her husband are raising, get this, a zero carbon footprint baby. I'll give you my hits and misses of the week, including the controversial 60-minute story on clean tech and a couple of others that you'll be interested in. So without further ado, let's get started. First up, today we are delighted to have Melanie Nutter with us, who is director of the Department of the Environment for the City and County of San Francisco, where she helps residents and businesses get active in protecting and enhancing the environment, the urban environment, and having a focus on sustainable practices. Welcome to Green Connections.
Thanks, Joan.
You're doing the Zero Waste Program in San Francisco, giving grants to local nonprofits and community groups to, in effect, go green. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. So at the Department of the Environment, we have a number of different program areas, but one of them is around zero waste. The City and County of San Francisco set a goal of achieving zero waste by 2020, and as of 2010, we are diverting 80% of our waste from the landfill. So we've made great progress with our very easy-to-use three-bin system, green for compost, blue for recycling, and black for trash. And that is a system you can see throughout the residential sector as well as the business sector in San Francisco. We also have a couple of other components that helped us get to that 80% diversion. We offer financial incentives. So the more that businesses or residents recycle and compost, the lower their garbage bill. So there's a built-in incentive to do the right thing and to separate your trash properly. Our zero waste grant program, as you mentioned, is an opportunity for us to engage local community groups who want to be part of the zero waste solution and are trying innovative things, whether it's working in residential hotels to find zero waste ambassadors that then work with the residents to help them do source separation, whether it's working with small businesses and helping them set up their front of the house recycling and composting system. So our zero waste program funds local community groups who are helping us achieve zero waste. And we just in this past round of grants gave out about $1 million to help us achieve that zero waste goal.
Wow. Well, I want to get back to the financial incentives for a second. So did you do some kind of market research to decide that, to find out that there was a need for financial incentives and how much, or how did you go about determining to give financial incentives and how much to give?
So that's a great question. A department like Department of the Environment, really what we have at our disposal to influence behavior change is either carrots or sticks or both. And some of the carrots that we can offer is financial incentives and rebates. That's, you know, a accepted practice in the environmental sector to spur the right behavior, whether it's providing a rebate for installing a solar array on your home, or in this case, providing a reduction in your garbage bill to incentivize the right behavior. It's been very effective in getting people to pay attention and to participate in the zero waste program because it helps their bottom line while helping the environment.
Oh, that's cool. I saw some information on your SF311 app. Okay, I love that app. So let me get this straight. Like when I was in San Francisco for Verge a couple months ago, I did see potholes and I did see all kinds of stuff that I was thinking, you know, if I wanted to report this, you know, what would I do? And lo and behold, Melanie Nutter has given me an app. So now if I'm a taxi cab driver, I would imagine it sees them the most, or a citizen. If they see something, what do they do?
Sure. So Mayor Lee has really championed the use of the 311 service for making government more responsive, as well as collecting data about what needs to be fixed in the city. So a couple of months ago, the city released the SF311 app, and what it is essentially an additional tool beyond the 311 phone number for residents to alert the city of problems that need to be fixed. So one of them is potholes. Another is overflowing public garbage cans in our public space. Another one is graffiti. Sometimes it's illegal dumping. So some of these issues that affect the quality of life of our residents, now by having this app, they have a tool to take a picture, submit it to 311, and then also use that app to get information back from the government about when is that being handled, has it been taken care of, and on what timeline. So it really increases the responsiveness of government as well as the communication between government and our residents. So we're really excited about it, and it's been hugely popular since it was launched.
Well, it provides a lot of transparency as well. I mean, as we talked about at Verge, data that you mentioned is a key factor in the trending right now. And with all the technology, we're almost swimming in data. But this also provides transparency by showing when it's being handled and by whom.
Exactly. And it shows that that type of request isn't just falling into a void and not getting handled. They can really see government officials being accountable and responsible for taking care of our communities and for our residents. So it's really a win-win on both sides.
You've been involved in collaborating with other city leaders. I remember you were recently doing a trip to Barcelona, for example. Are other cities around the world using technology in this way, especially for energy and environment-related issues and for citizen engagement and transparency?
Yes, so quite a few cities, both in the U.S. as well as around the world, have started to use 311-type services. And the conference that I attended in Barcelona was the World Smart Cities Expo, where there were actually quite a few, both European as well as North American cities, as well as cities from around the world, talking about what cities are doing at the local level to use technology as a tool to increase sustainability and to increase livability and transparency for their residents and their businesses. So like a lot of cities, San Francisco has set a very ambitious carbon emission reduction goal, which is to reduce our carbon by 80% below 1990 levels by 2050. And right now, we're at 14.5% below 1990 levels, which is great progress. But to get from 14.5% to 80% by 2050, we really need some additional game-changing tools to help us meet those challenges. And so that's where a lot of sustainability directors are looking to the clean tech and technology sector and the open data movement to see where and how we can add technology as a tool to our toolbox to continue to accelerate progress.
Yeah, I bet. What comes to mind is kind of reverse engineering, where the data might point out inflection points that could be addressed by technology. In other words, we use technology to collect information, but then stepping back and analyzing the data and seeing where the spikes and dips are can help guide us to the areas that we need to innovate in.
Exactly. And a perfect example of that is building energy data. And in San Francisco, we have an ordinance called the Existing Commercial Building Ordinance, and it requires that all commercial buildings 10,000 square feet and over need to report their energy use data to the city. The reason that's really useful for the city as well as for the property owners is it's using data as a tool to make decisions about how to improve building performance as well as energy use buildings. And so, for instance, we have something called the SF Energy Map that has been a great tool for residents and businesses to be able to add in their address and see what their renewable energy potential is for their home or for their business, as well as what rebates they can access. And what that has resulted in is San Francisco having about 4,000 solar installations, as well as about 23 megawatts of power that are coming from renewable energy right now.
Before I let you go, I'm fascinated that you're in this work and you're not an engineer. You actually have training, if I'm reading this correctly, in communications and environmental studies, but you're not an engineer, you're not a physicist, you're not a scientist, and yet you are in green. And I love this because so many people think that the only way you can have a career in energy and sustainability is if you're an engineer or a physicist or something in science. And that you're a perfect example of somebody who doesn't have that kind of a background and yet is hugely successful in this. Tell us about how you got from your Bachelor of Science degree to where you are now.
My background really is in, I got a degree both in communications as well as in environmental politics. And, you know, part of moving the ball forward as it relates to environment is science-based. And that's why I've been blessed to work at Department of the Environment with a lot of engineers and a lot of technical staff that we do have here working at Department of the Environment. But part of it is also about how do you build support and how do you find stakeholders to champion these scientific breakthroughs or to champion really the behavior change element of doing the right thing as it comes to the environment. There's room for all different types of folks to be involved in the environmental movement as it relates, again, to building support as well as doing the outreach and education that's important for individual lives and for individual choices to be made that either can help or hinder the environment in the short term and long term.
Exactly. So thank you for your participation, and look forward to chatting with you again, and have a wonderful holiday and a happy new year.
Thank you. You too. And it was nice to talk to you today.
Melanie Nutter of San Francisco is so amazing, isn't she? She's just extraordinary. Please email me your questions for her and your reactions to her. I mean, diverting 80% of waste from landfill is extraordinary. I mean, think about that. Do you divert 80% of the waste that you generate in your household? I recycle, but as you've probably heard me say before, there are cities around the country that still don't recycle, which makes me crazy. Speaking of recycling, that's really a behavior change. And that was one of the things that Melanie talked about, and that seems to be a recurring theme here, is that behavior change is really where it's at and what the next critical step is. There are financial incentives to get people to take sustainable actions and eco-friendly actions. It's about outreach. It's about connecting and peer pressure. Melanie talked about either a carrot or a stick. You know, they both tend to work at times, but it seems that the carrot works more effectively. One of the examples of that is her Zero Waste Grant Program and the innovators that are being funded and how it is driving people to change behaviors. And their 311 app, I love that. I just love that. And reporting graffiti and public trash bins overflowing. I got to tell you, just recently I saw some public trash bins overflowing, and I would have loved to have been able to report it. If we're going to get anything like that in the D.C. area, wouldn't that be a great idea? Mayor Gray, if you're listening, and new Governor Terry McAuliffe, if you're listening, we could use something like that here. And like the San Francisco Energy Map, again, it's a tool, it's a technology as a tool, it's data as a tool to find out where your rebates are, what your energy use is. These are all tools that we can use. But one of the things that I really want to focus on that she said is for anybody who is not an engineer and not a physicist and wants to have a job in energy and sustainability, look at Melanie as a model. Okay, she is not an engineer. She's not a physicist. Her job is to bring their ideas to the public and to the policymakers and make them a reality. You can be a communicator. You can be a finance person. You can be an operations person. You can be an administrative person. So there are jobs in this space that are way cool, making an amazing difference without being an engineer. Thank you again for joining us. We'll be right back with more from Green Connections.
Capital Audio Post, your one-stop shop for your post-production needs. 703-712-8757.
Our services include video editing, sound design, sound mixing, ISDN recording, and many other media-related services.
Let us finish your project no matter where you are, across the U.S. or across the world. Go to www.capitalaudiopost.com. Call us at 703-712-8757.
Let us know how we can help you finish your production.
Welcome back to Green Connections, where we help you live green, work green, and earn green. I'm Joan Michelson. Find us on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at Joan Michelson. And find us online on greenconnectionsradio.com and on Talkers Radio Network. Now I'd like you to meet Melissa Walsh Innes. Melissa is the loveliest garbage lady you'll ever meet. Melissa is the Deputy Director for Recycling Reinvented, a national nonprofit advocating for companies to take a bigger role in the recycling process. The goal of Recycling Reinvented is to get consumer product companies and government and environmental organizations and people like you and me to dramatically increase U.S. recycling rates. And boy, do we need to do that. I've seen some statistics. Only 8% of the plastic and recyclable material that we generate in the United States is actually recycled. That, folks, is unacceptable. Melissa is also a former state legislator in Maine, having served on Maine's Joint Standing Committee on Environment and Natural Resources, and she's working on a sustainable MBA from the University of California at Irvine. One of the interesting things about Recycling Reinvented that makes us all pay more attention is they have a pretty impressive board of directors. It includes Bobby Kennedy Jr. and the chairman and CEO of Nestle Waters. So I guess they're pretty serious about what they're doing and bringing a diverse set of stakeholders together. Let's listen to my conversation with Melissa and learn about how recycling really works and how we can do it better. Welcome to Green Connections, Melissa.
Thank you, Joan. It's great to be here with you.
Thank you for joining us. So, first of all, I have a pet peeve that I have to get off my chest. Since you work for in the recycling industry, I just spent 8 days in Paradise Valley, Arizona, and they do not recycle. It is a densely populated area, and at the event I was at with you yesterday, one of the speakers talked about how dense areas tend to have the best recycling programs.
Well, I wish I could. It doesn't make any sense to either myself or you. Yes, you would assume that a large area like that would have not only recycling, that they would have curbside collection of the recycling. And it's really shocking, I think, for people to hear that that's not the norm in our country. And that would definitely lead to your point about the fact that it's really around 8%. And those numbers can go up maybe as high as 20%. But most of the items that are recyclable in our country are not getting recycled.
What is recyclable?
A lot of items are recyclable. The four major categories would be paper, metal, glass, and plastic. And when you think about all of the items that we bring into our households, especially what we work in is packaging and printed paper, the majority of those items are made out of those four categories, those commodity groups.
So, okay, take us through a day in the life of a cardboard box or a bottle that gets picked up in my driveway from the recycle truck. What happened?
You buy a product that comes in a box. You take your purchase out, put it in your recycling bin if you have curbside recycling. You bring it outside on the designated day. They'll come and pick it up.
Who is they?
Well, it's different in every town, every municipality, and every state. It's generally is private haulers. In some situations, it's actually the municipalities. So it's there's quite a variance across the country.
Okay, so what happens after they pick up everything from the bins?
Yep, they would actually bring it back to their recovery facilities. They're called MRFs, M-R-F, Material Recovery Facilities. And they would actually go through a process on a conveyor belt where all of the different items would be separated along the way. Some of it is done with by hand, but a lot of it is done with machinery.
But then how do it's the consumer product companies that are going to use this stuff. So recycled means it goes back into use. How does it get to Colgate, Palmolive, or Kraft, or whoever?
They would take the materials once they're separated in the MRF, in the facility, and then they would bale them together in these large bales, and then those are then purchased by manufacturers that would want to use those items to make new materials.
So Recycling Reinvented, you're trying to reinvent recycling. So what do you want to see happen in your perfect world?
Oh, in our perfect world. In our perfect world, every state in the U.S. would have recycling programs for printed paper and packaging, and those programs would be financed and managed by industry, by the industry members, the brands that create these products. They would then be responsible for the end-of-life care of those products. But the industry would pay for the system. So in our belief, and we actually have a study that we're working on right now, and those numbers are coming out to support that the cost of recycling for the states would actually come down. And it not only would come down, convenience for household members who want to recycle would go up. So it's a vision that we know can be achieved because Europe and Canada are already doing this. We're just a little bit farther behind, but we see what can happen. We know that right now you can take the state of Minnesota, which is a state that we're studying, and from one town to another, there's different products that can be recycled.
So the MRFs, I love that name. It reminds me of Smurfs and Little Blue People. So the MRFs would make a deal, say, directly with Nestle or with Kraft or with Procter & Gamble, so they could conceivably have different, like a host of different contracts with as many companies as there are out there that produce this stuff. Aren't there like 10,000 consumer product companies or something? I mean, how is that realistic?
So what would have to happen and what has been happening in the other countries that have done this is that the industry members would actually create a nonprofit organization, which would be the umbrella organization to administer these programs.
One of the things that comes to my mind is, in some ways, it seems like you represent industry and industry's voice without being a lobbyist, without being their particular PR firm, if you will. Do the environmentalists push back on Recycling Reinvented and say, you're not really for the environment because you work for industry, you work for the bad guys?
Yeah, it does get confusing. And I do. There definitely are people that have felt that we're representing industry. One of the ways that we work to bridge that divide is to go out and present to these groups. We've had a lot of invitations to come and present what we're doing. We also have a very interesting board of directors. We have Bobby Kennedy Jr., who's a noted environmentalist. And then we have Kim Jeffrey, the chairman of Nestle Waters North America. It's very helpful for us to be able to show that we have a diverse group of people that are not just in the industry side, but they're also working to protect the environment, to bring corporate responsibility into every boardroom. So because myself and our executive director, Paul Gardner, who's from a former Minnesota state legislator, we both have backgrounds working in the environmental field. Paul was a recycling coordinator for the State Recycling Association for 9 years. So our environmental credentials hopefully are helpful in having people see us in a productive role of bringing industry and environmental organizations and trade associations and government together to try to forge a plan that would actually work.
So just to wrap up, two quick things. One is, it seems to me that with all the natural disasters recently, that there's an opportunity to build a model program. It seems to me that places like New Orleans or the areas of New Jersey and New York hit by Superstorm Sandy, et cetera, that were completely devastated and really have to build their infrastructure up from the ground, literally all over again, and new systems, that those would be ripe opportunities to do it right the first time.
Yeah, that would be a great plan for a organization to take on, because that when you see all of these natural disasters, which are just horrible when you see them, and then what they don't always show often is all of the material that they're having to bulldoze out of those areas. It's you know, acres and acres of materials. That's all construction and demolition debris, and that can all be, I won't say all, almost all of that can be reused and recycled.
So part of emergency management planning becomes recycling or putting into good reuse the debris from the disaster. We're sorry the disaster happened, but part of the actual emergency management strategy plan is what happens with this material and gets it back into recycling instead of just dumped in a dumpster in a landfill.
Absolutely.
So while we're doing wish lists, what's your plan for 2014?
Yeah, I'm really excited for 2014. We're going to have our study results of what recycling costs right now in Minnesota and what it would cost if we were able to implement an EPR for paper and packaging program in Minnesota. And we're going to be able to show people that it's going to cost less than overall costs right now, and then it's going to cost less to consumers, and more materials are going to be recycled. And it's also going to create less need for landfilling and burning. So those are some great findings that we're going to be able to share with people.
So you're coming out with the results of your survey in March, and you're modeling, creating a model program based on that data. And then your goal is to have that model program rolled out across the country in as many places as can happen, especially in this crazy political environment.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, thank you so much, Melissa, for what you do every day to try to pick up our garbage and make it used. It's kind of interesting. I mean, when you go to a cocktail party, do you say I'm in the garbage collection business or something?
I already say I like to talk trash.
Oh, I love that. That's perfect. That's fabulous. Well, it's been a delight to have you on Green Connections. Thank you for being here. Thank you for what you do every day. Thank you for being a woman role model in this industry. People don't normally associate lovely young ladies with trash. But there we go. So thank you again. So what I heard Melissa say really kind of blows me away. I mean, folks, we got to recycle. You know, we have to do this. A woman at a presentation yesterday said the keys to recycling are convenience, policies, cost, and outreach, and putting in policies that include pay as you throw. I love pay as you throw. But we have to get these policies in place. But what I also heard her say is that we, the taxpayers, are paying part of the bill, and so is industry, but it's not working. So we're paying for a system that doesn't work. That doesn't make sense, okay? They've come up with a better way. Recycling reinvented, and industry are trying to develop a better way. It makes perfect sense because industry are the people and the companies that are using this material that's being produced. The plastic bottles can't get back to Nestle or Coca-Cola if they don't get there. I mean, they can't reuse them if they don't get there. And natural disasters, we have to seize this opportunity. I mean, natural disasters are awful, okay? Let's just say that. But every time there's a community that goes through a tornado like in Oklahoma or Superstorm Sandy or the hurricane like Katrina, there's an opportunity to rebuild the infrastructure there. And there's also an opportunity with FEMA to put this reuse of this garbage from the natural disaster into their strategy. There's no excuse for that in today's world. These things are very systematized. They have policies, they have programs, and there's no excuse for it not to be in there. I really look forward to the survey that Recycling Reinvented is doing to find out what is really happening on the ground, what people are willing to pay for, who's willing to pay it, how this is really going to work, because we have to learn to do this differently. 8% of the waste we create that is recyclable, being recycled, is unacceptable and unsustainable. So tell us what you're doing in your neighborhood to recycle more effectively. Thank you again, Melissa, for sharing your information with us, and we very much look forward to this survey. We'll be right back.
A domain name is your key to doing business around the world, right from your office, living room, or even your couch. And finding the right name is as easy as a domain name search at hostingforcheap.com. Just enter the domain you want in the search box and we'll give you the results, along with similar domains you may not have considered. Most people looking for goods or services start on the web. Unfortunately, many small businesses can't afford to pay someone else to build their website. That's where hostingforcheap.com comes in. We can show you how to create a website for yourself, because hostingforcheap.com isn't just about domain names. It's a one-stop shop for anything you need to get online, from building your own website to attracting new customers to securing their data when they make a purchase. Hostingforcheap.com has you covered from the moment you decide you want to put your business on the web. That's hostingforcheap.com. Hostingforcheap.com. Hostingforcheap.com.
His name is Robbie Student. Interesting name. Interesting guy. Robbie Student is a philosopher. He's a record producer. He's a political observer. And he isn't afraid to open his mouth. But he ain't no wonk. He's a person. He's a husband, a dad, a real regular guy. Okay, maybe he's not so regular. But I mean, he's not weird or anything like that. He's somewhat of a loose cannon. Although I mean that in a completely positive way. Okay, mostly positive. You never know. Robbie Student. He's the kind of guy you just want to hang with a couple of hours a day. Or maybe just a few minutes a day. He can be hard to take. But then again, so are most people hard to take. Whatever. Robbie Student does talk radio here Sunday evenings with a brand new show live between 9 and 11 p.m. Eastern Time that you can call into. When Robbie Student is on the air, you never know what's going to happen, which certainly makes it interesting. Robbie Student, 1 to 3, Eastern, Monday through Friday, only on Talkers Radio.
Capital Audio Post, your one-stop shop for your post-production needs. 703-712-8757.
Our services include video editing, sound design, sound mixing, ISDN recording, and many other media-related services.
Let us finish your project no matter where you are, across the U.S. or across the world. Go to www.capitalaudiopost.com. Call us at 703-712-8757.
Let us know how we can help you finish your production.
Welcome back to Green Connections. We help you live green, work green, and earn green. I'm Joan Michelson. Like us on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at Joan Michelson. Listen to us on Talkers Radio Network and at greenconnectionsradio.com. Send me your comments and suggestions for stories and people that we should have conversations with at info@greenconnectionsradio.com. I had the extreme privilege this week of meeting Amory Lovins, who is a legend in the energy business. Amory Lovins is the co-founder and chief scientist of the Rocky Mountain Institute, a prolific author, a prolific inventor, a prolific TED Talk speaker, and truly an innovator in the energy and sustainability space. He is one of those people who is literally putting his money and his time and his resources where his mouth is, innovating the energy business. He has spent 40 years in the energy business. Amory wrote a book called Reinventing Fire, Business Solutions for the Energy Era, which he and I spoke about, and definitely belongs on the shelf and the reading table of anybody interested in innovation in the energy industry. Let's listen to my conversation with Amory Lovins.
60 colleagues and I put out a book a couple of years ago called Reinventing Fire, Bold Business Solutions for the New Energy Era, that addresses that question, at least with regard to energy and everything connected to energy, and that's a pretty good master key for the whole range of sustainability issues. And we found that the United States, for example, could run a 2.5-fold bigger economy in 2050 with no oil, no coal, no nuclear energy, a third less natural gas, $5 trillion cheaper than business as usual, counting all hidden or external costs at zero, needing no new inventions and no acts of Congress, the transition led by business for profit. Now, to get there, we integrated all four sectors that use energy that are normally considered separately, namely transportation, buildings, industry, and electricity. We found, for example, it's a lot easier to solve the car and electricity problems together than separately. We also integrated four kinds of innovation. Normally, people count just two, namely technology and public policy, but there are two even more powerful ones normally left out, namely design, the way we combine technologies, and strategy, new business models, new competitive strategies. And when you play with a full deck with all four kinds of innovation, you get some really disruptive business opportunities, and you get a lot more than the sum of the parts.
How do we get to this energy picture that you just described? What has to happen in the energy sector to get there?
Well, the incumbents have to realize that their business models won't work anymore under the onslaught of the insurgents and decide how they're going to use their assets and skills and capabilities to thrive in the new world, or they may simply decide to go away.
How do insurgents and the establishment, especially in industries like the utility business, which is so entrenched and so
locked in a very difficult situation right now, too, where they have to reinvent their business model and reinvent how they make money and make more by selling less and et cetera, all without dropping a moment of service to anyone. So, I mean, this is the thing that fascinates me. Is we have to reinvent the way we get our power without ever losing any power. A restaurant can shut down for renovation, okay? We can't do that with the grid. We can't do that with the utility business.
There's certainly a very interesting set of conversations, and it's time now that we did this also in the oil industry, which is kind of like airlines. It's a great industry and a bad business. I've been working in it for about 40 years, and I'm actually a member of the National Petroleum Council, although probably the only one driving an electric car whose license plate says off oil. and why do I say it's a bad business? You may think it's immensely powerful and profitable. Well, in good years, yes. In bad years, no. And it has some really discouraging fundamentals. It's very capital intensive, very long lead time, very high geological and technological and political risks.
Well, yes, exactly. The danger and the national security issues are huge. Where do you come down on fracking and natural gas? You mentioned using a third less natural gas as your picture of where we can be by 2050. How do we get there, and where do you come down on fracking? I mean, I'd love to be a fly on the wall in your meetings at the American Petroleum Institute.
Well, that was actually quite a pleasant meeting. but I think a lot of people are starting to realize and to agree privately with this view of the world that that fracking for natural gas alone is not economic at anything like today's prices. That is, the so-called dry gas by itself costs too much. And therefore, essentially all the drilling and activity are being driven by gas that has a bunch of oil in it that's worth four times more than the gas. Meanwhile, gas prices are volatile. And the cheaper the gas is at the wellhead, actually, the more volatile the price downstream to the customer becomes. Now, volatile prices impose risk. Just as, why is an adjustable rate mortgage cheaper, looks cheaper than a fixed rate mortgage, but why do many people choose a fixed rate mortgage at a higher price? Because you don't want the risk of losing your house if interest rates spike.
We can't do all this without a workforce. And so where are we going to get the workforce of the future to support these new industries that both in the new energy economy and in the sustainability field?
There's a wide range of national, state, and local programs, some of them based at community colleges and vo-techs, to retrain people or to train them from scratch. And in fact, America now has, for example, more solar jobs than we have coal or steel jobs.
Really?
Yeah. And in Europe, there's already well over a million new clean energy jobs. This has happened with remarkable speed, and it's starting to happen a lot faster. Although gradually we're actually getting more efficient in like how we install solar panels on your roof, so we don't need as many people as we are adding solar panels, but it's a very promising line of work, and the same for the wind industry, and they have created a lot of jobs in almost every congressional district, including, obviously, a great many Republican ones.
And I lived in North Dakota for a couple of years, and as Byron Dorgan is fond of saying, they're born leaning because there's so much wind there. I was levitated. Innovation is happening in the private sector and in many of the areas you describe, but where it's not happening is on the regulatory side, and there's limited innovation on the financial side, financial modeling. Obviously, businesses need the regulatory environment to get it together and get more creative and reconfigure some of these regulations, tighten some, restructure others. And the financial models need to be put in place. I mean, I've gotten to know Jigar Shah, for example, who reinvented some of the financing models for solar. So Where is that innovation going to come from? How is that going to happen?
Well, actually, there is a lot of both regulatory and financing innovation, and it's kind of oozing up through the cracks all over in the financial community and among entrepreneurs and occasionally governments. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has been doing a terrific job of competition and transparent pricing, so that now in over 30 states, ways to save electricity or use it at better times can compete directly against supply. We have decoupled at a state level utilities' revenues and profits from their energy sales. So we're starting to reward them for cutting your bill, not for selling more energy. And the other 35 or so states need to do that too. So I think innovation of many kinds is needed. It's not all about technology. And fortunately, we're starting to see those moving parts come together in ways that I think will transform the energy system beyond recognition in the next decade.
Great. Well, thank you so much. I only hope that the entrenched interests don't derail them before we can give them a chance to take flight. So thank you so much for all you've done for energy and sustainability over the last many decades and your books. We'll have a link to their website and to his books on greenconnectionsradio.com. Thank you again for joining us. I'm Joan Michelson from Green Connections. Thanks. Amory is extraordinary, isn't he? He's just incredible. I mean, I want to hear what you thought, what came to your mind as you were listening to him. My quote of the week has to be from Amory when he said, "America has more solar jobs now than coal or steel jobs." Think about that for a moment. America has more solar jobs now than steel or coal jobs. That's amazing. I mean, that is a sign of the times. And his discussion about utilities, reinventing utilities, they are in very much a difficult position. They can't shut down like a restaurant can to renovate. And his comments actually made me feel a lot better about the utility sector looking for solutions and figuring out ways to make more money selling less of their product. It's quite remarkable. One of the key things, though, that really stuck with me, there were three things that really stuck with me about my conversation with him. One was four kinds of innovation that you need to have design and business models integrated into the process, as well as technology and policy. Design and business models are coming up more and more as necessary parts of an integrated process of innovation, that it can't just be a technology and then we find a policy that enables it or something. You have to have all of these integrated at the same time. The second thing that really struck me that I want to point out now is insurgents driving the established players to innovate. You know, entrepreneurs and innovators who are nipping at the heels and trying things differently, you know, you think you're not being heard and you think you're not making a difference, when in fact, the insurgents are driving the established players to make changes for the betterment of all, for the resource conservation. And last, but certainly not least, I'd love to be a fly on the wall in a meeting with Amory Lovins and the National Petroleum Council. Wouldn't that be amazing? I applaud them. I applaud the National Petroleum Council for including Amory in their discussions. That makes me feel like they are taking environmental concerns and the promise of renewable energies much more seriously than I feared they might be, to including someone of Amory's stature and Amory's depth and Amory's values in their discussions. Makes me feel a lot better about the future of the energy business. Stay tuned, because coming up next, we're going to take a complete right turn. Do you have kids? Think about raising a zero carbon footprint baby. Think about that for a moment. Raising a child is very resource intensive. We're going to talk to a woman who is raising a zero carbon footprint baby and find out how she's done it. Wait till you hear her strategies. Talk to you in a moment.
Every Sunday evening at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 5 p.m. Pacific, well-known talk radio and television personality Alan Combs hosts a very special and different one-hour program called Healed Planet with Alan Combs. It's quite a departure from the Alan Combs we all hear on Fox News Radio and television. It has very little to do with politics and everything to do with cosmic consciousness. Healed Planet with Alan Combs explores parapsychology, astrophysics, quantum mechanics, the environment, the meaning of dreams, synchronicity, theories of life after death, 21st century spirituality, and the mysteries of the universe, all in one dynamic, open-minded, leading-edge radio program. Don't miss Healed Planet with Alan Combs, Sunday evenings at 8 ET, right here on the Verbal Gymnasium of the World Wide Web, Talkers Radio.
Welcome back to Green Connections Radio, where we help you live green, work green, and earn green. I'm Joan Michelson. Find us on Talkers Radio Network and on greenconnectionsradio.com. Like us on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at Joan Michelson. Okay, so now we're into this week's hits and misses, and this week they are a doozy. We'll start on a positive note. A round of applause goes to Tesla's S sedan for garnering a 5-star safety rating from the formidable NHTSA, National Highway Transportation Safety Administration. Bravo. Very good. Electric car gets 5-star rating in safety tests. Fabulous. And a round of applause to the musicians who brought us Green Connections' own theme music, Dick Wagner and my sister Susie Michelson, for their song and video Gift to benefit St. Jude Children's Hospital. All proceeds from downloading the song on iTunes go to the hospital. You can find the link on our website, greenconnectionsradio.com. And a bop on the head to the city of Paradise Valley, Arizona, for not having a recycling program, at least not one that picks up from residents' homes. Speaking of my sister Susie, she lives there, and I know it firsthand. So, guys, get it together. And now for a word about the 60 Minutes story this past Sunday. It was called Clean Tech Crash, and it must get a bop on the head. Full disclosure, I worked at 60 Minutes years ago. I would suggest that Don Hewitt would never have let this story air the way it did. It was factually incorrect and biased and presented only one point of view. Venture capitalist Vinod Khosla made a valiant try at defending Clean Tech, but it wasn't enough. One person they should have included is Dr. Cheryl Martin, the deputy director of ARPA-E, who said on my panel last year at the Green Biz Verge conference that it's government's job to remove the technical risk of breakthrough innovations, especially in energy, which is the lifeblood of the economy. Ironically, this story on 60 Minutes ran the same week that the New York Times published a story called, quote, "Solar Power Surge Sweeping Wall Street," unquote. Reconcile those two for me. Innovation requires trial and error, folks, and that means that not all investments will thrive. That's the point. These so-called failures lead to successes down the road, and that's why we need government to absorb the technical risk. That's how we got to the moon. And as Vinod Khosla pointed out in the 60 Minutes piece, that's how we've made advances in cancer detection and treatments, extending lives heroically. So speaking of heroics, my final round of applause this week goes to Joe Rahm of the Center for American Progress for his cogent, factual, and immediate rebuttal to the 60 Minutes piece, where he pointed out how extraordinary the advances in clean tech have been, including a dramatic reduction in the prices of solar and wind, and the equally dramatic surge in solar and wind energy installations. Tell us your hits and misses of the week and what you thought of the 60 Minutes segment on clean tech. Post your thoughts on our Facebook page, tweet it to me on Twitter at Joan Michelson, or email it to us at info@greenconnectionsradio.com. And finally today, I'm here today with a delightful author of a delightful book. Kia Chatterjee is the Senior Director for Renewable Energy and Footprint Outreach at the World Wildlife Fund. She wrote a book recently called The Zero Footprint Baby, How to Save the Planet While Raising a Healthy Baby. Okay, there's so much we can talk about here. A little bit more about Kia's background. Her commentary on climate change policy and sustainability has been quoted everywhere you could possibly go. USA Today, New York Times, and even the NBC Nightly News, which is very cool, and our local Washington Post. She was a Peace Corps volunteer in Morocco. I actually visited Morocco. We can talk about that sometime. She recently rode her bike from New York City to Washington, D.C. as part of Climate Ride. Oh, my goodness. She has a bachelor's and master's degrees in environmental science from the University of Virginia. Welcome to Green Connections.
Thank you so much for having me, Joan.
You're welcome. Tell us a little bit about the most surprising thing that you encountered in deciding to raise your child with a zero carbon footprint.
Well, I think the most surprising thing for us was that it was even possible. You know, I started doing all this research about how we could reduce our carbon footprint and what we could do in our home, what we could do about how we get around, diapers and feeding. And I was doing all this research thinking in my mind that really what we could accomplish was just having less of an impact. And when I started adding up all the numbers and realizing, wow, we can actually continue to reduce our carbon footprint, even having an additional person in the home.
How much time does it take? Because it seems to me that it might be more labor intensive and time intensive.
Yeah, I think it's a totally different lifestyle. And so I think the way we use our time is really different from the way we used to use our time. Because what happens is in the summertime, we're always at the pool. We're always at the fountains. There are these great new parks. And we meet so many families and we meet up with friends all the time. Same thing in the wintertime. And so it's not that it takes time. It's just we use our time really, really differently.
For some of the apartment dwellers who are listening, so the buildings often amortize the cost of power over various apartments, especially for heat. And some of it's on your electrical bill and some of it is amortized across. And so basically they'd be paying for it anyway.
Yeah.
But I took this up with my building and I said, for me to be making an effort to be reducing my energy use and my water use, still having to pay the same amount because everybody else is using the same, doesn't seem fair.
Yeah. No, it's absolutely true. And I think in my book, what I try and do is have sections that are for people who live in apartments and people who live in homes. But there's a real, you know, there's a misalignment of incentives when you don't have apartments billed for their energy. And that's something that, you know, it's great that you brought it up with your own building. And that's the kind of thing I also talk about a lot in the book. But then, you know, I have a few chapters in the end that are all about people around you, getting more support from people around you, whether that's your family and friends, but also getting more support from society at large. So that could be your landlord.
But I would imagine you also get pushback from some of your peers in society because especially raising a kid and being, you know, parenting is extremely emotional. It's emotionally charged, right? And everybody wants to believe that the way they're doing it is the right way.
Yeah.
So how did you handle when people would basically attack you and say, you know, oh, you're hurting your child or how dare you or whatever, when in fact, what you're really doing is showing a way that they didn't choose. You know, they chose something different. How did you react?
A lot of what I do is just try to reword questions into questions that I'm willing to answer. And I have a section in the book that's about how to deal with friends and family because we did get a lot. You know, I wouldn't say a lot, but we got people who were highly, highly critical of what we were doing. And for me, you know, someone will say like, oh well, you know, like you have leather shoes on, so how dare you do blank? And I'll say, you know what? I think really what you're trying to ask is 100% of my actions don't seem to be consistent with what I'm saying. And how do I achieve that balance? And then I answer the question I'm willing to answer, which is that question. And so I think that's a great tactic in general is just to take what they say, try and take the emotion out of it. And
that's a great idea. So basically you step back, you don't let them hook you and you take a step back and reframe it in your head. Oh, I love that. Let me get to a couple. Just really quickly, can you give us some tips for people who might not have the time or the money or the knowledge that you have, some things that are easier for sort of the average American to do?
So, I mean, I think that the three areas of your life that make the biggest difference are your electricity use, the way you get around and transportation, and what you consume, particularly food. So if you start to think in those three areas, there's a lot that can be done. So for example, around electricity, people don't realize how cheap solar panels have gotten, for example. You know, there are about 50 million homes in America that today would save money by installing solar panels on their roof, and they don't even realize it because costs have come down dramatically. You know, obviously, saving energy saves money, but moving to renewable sources of energy also saves money. Same thing around transportation. Getting a more efficient car has a dramatic effect compared to a lot of other actions that you can take. And then around consumption, you know, and food in particular, one place to focus that I think is relatively easy for people is around food waste. So in this country, you know, estimates vary, but, you know, we throw away nearly half of the food that we produce. So we spend a lot of energy making fertilizer, transporting food, growing this food, and we throw a lot of it away.
So are you talking about like using food for food waste for compost if you have a garden? I mean, we did a story on DC Central Kitchen, which collects, they call it a food recovery program. So they collect the food in kitchens that's not used and in farms and supermarkets, produce that can't be sold because it's not perfect enough, and they chop it up and make meals from it. And I, you know, I just loved that story. That was really great. But people, I mean, food waste, I'm the queen of doggy bags, and I have people who laugh at me all the time about it. And I'm like, hey, I'm not going to waste it.
Yeah.
You know, plain and simple. And, you know, I eat less more often. So I'm actually going to eat this,
yeah.
You know, later. I might freeze it and eat it later, but, you know, nonetheless. So were you talking about that kind of managing your food waste, or are you talking about compost or...
Well, both are great, but what we try to do is the kind of stuff you were talking about in terms of making sure the food gets eaten. And some of the stuff you want to do is real simple, you know, and it's stuff that kids can really help with. So if you can, like, tell your kids, hey, remind me every week that we got to eat the berries before we eat the apples, get them, you know, being the watchdogs in your family, too. And, use leftovers, use the freezer. You know, it's just a question, to some degree, of people paying attention to. You know, it's just we're so blessed in this society. And honestly, this is something that saves a lot of money in households, too. And I think that resonates as well.
Cool. Well, thank you so much, Kia Chatterjee, author of The Zero Carbon Footprint Baby, How to Save the Planet While Raising a Healthy Baby. And you can get it on Amazon. We'll have the link on our website as well. I loved her point about engaging kids as the watchdogs. I do sequence eating certain vegetables and things in order myself. So the most surprising thing to me, though, was how easy Kia said it was for her and her family to make this transition. And that's fascinating to me. Is it easy because she has so much innate knowledge because she works in the field? Or is it easy for all of us and we're just not taking the steps to go there? But I think one of the biggest takeaways for me as a communicator was reframing the question from people. When people would kind of attack her for her choices and say, you know, you're hurting your baby or blah, 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 that she would reframe it to a question that she wanted to answer and was willing to answer. And that disarmed the moment and took the charge out of it and then was able to share some information in a very disarming way. So I just love this and I'd love to hear your thoughts. And if you're trying to raise a zero carbon footprint baby or a zero carbon footprint toddler, tell us what your neighborhood is doing to be energy efficient. And do you get tax credits for energy audits and retrofits, for example, on your home? Who do you know that we should be talking to about energy efficient and sustainable neighborhoods? Especially women leaders. Email me at info@greenconnectionsradio.com, post it on our Facebook page, and follow me on Twitter. Send it to me on Twitter @Joan Michelson. Thanks for joining us at Green Connections. I'm Joan Michelson. See you next week.